Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Pai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, I'm featuring Michael Epstein talking about the launch of the Immersive Impact Review, which happened at South by Southwest this year. They had their opening party at 4 p.m. on March 13th, 2026, that opening Friday of South by Southwest. And so I had a chance to sit down with Michael just to get a sense of this new effort that's funded by Agog. This is a hybrid journalistic and academic journal. They're asking these questions around how do you measure and demonstrate social impact? How do we justify the costs and trade-offs in immersive media versus more traditional media? So this is a new effort that is going to be coming out twice a year. And Agog itself, they're doing lots of funding of immersive projects, I think around $6.5 million so far that they've invested into the broader ecosystem. And I'll be having a conversation with Agog here in a few episodes because they're currently have an open call for climate futures and immersive media that's coming up here on June 12th, 2026. Definitely check it out as the deadline's coming up here. But wanted to sit down with Michael just to get a sense of the origins of this Immersive Impact Review and to talk about more broadly, what kind of ways can we start to think about trying to quantify or qualify different aspects of what makes immersive media unique. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Michael happened on Tuesday, March 17th, 2026 at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Yeah, my name is Michael Epstein. I am the managing editor at the Immersive Impact Review, which is a new online magazine exploring all types of immersive, but focusing on social impact, ways we can measure social impact, the history of these kind of socially oriented immersive experiences, and really trying to create a space where both journalists and academics can start writing and sharing information about the topic. My practice for the last 20 years has been in immersive audio and augmented reality. I'm very interested in site-specific experiences. So this would be audio and augmented reality walks through historic neighborhoods, usually in connection with a museum, a festival, or a civic organization. And the name of my production company is Walking Cinema. We're based in San Francisco.
Great. And maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Yeah, for sure. So I was probably from pretty young, was very sensitive to architecture and space. I remember when I was 10, I went on an architecture tour with my family, kicking and screaming and thinking this is going to be the most boring thing I ever saw. And then as soon as the tour guide started decoding the facade of the Fish Building and showing all this like sea life and like hidden shells and the marvels that were like contained in that architecture, and then showing me how even the slabs in the sidewalk were made to reflect the Bauhaus building's proportions, I started flipping out. I was like, oh, cool. Cities are like full of codes and they can be like decoded, and that architects are really thinking deeply about space and how we move through space. And I didn't go on to become an architect. I actually went on to become a journalist. I was a freelancer for Morning Edition and then a couple of radio shows in the early 2000s. And then went to MIT's Comparative Media Studies program and went there for 2 years. And this was really like a fantastic environment for me. Ostensibly, the program's about studying the history of media change going back to like the printing press, but then looking forward into the internet and how there's cyclical patterns in how new media formats are accepted and impact our culture. At the same time, they let you do a lot of media experiments. And that's when I first started thinking about, well, how can mobile technology be a new format for telling stories? And this kind of went into my journalism background, but also a lot of creative writing I had done. And so I started doing early experiments in and around Boston with mobile devices, first in the context of historic walking tours, how you could use games and other kind of small pieces of content to complement live actors who are like dressed up in old-time colonial outfits, but then got deeper into drama and theater. And coming out of MIT, we got a pretty big contract in Venice, Italy, to create a mobile experience around the Venice Biennale. This is in 2005. And so me and a team of architects, designers, media producers and storytellers got together at the University of Venice and put together an experience called History Unwired. And it was basically a branching narrative mobile experience of the neighborhood surrounding the Venice Biennale. It's a neighborhood called Castello. And we profiled four artists that are working in Venetian traditions, but doing very innovative things. The format was mobile audio, but you had a device. This is like even like pre-iPhone. So we had mobile devices that would allow you to see an animated map of where you're walking and where the route was, and then hearing stories from different characters as you went. But at certain points, you'd be able to go inside of semi-public places, places that we had agreements with, where audiences go inside and get a little bit more information on the character or the traditions of that neighborhood. And then also there was like video components too, to see how like one character made traditional Venetian glass, but he created like erotic figures and things that were not traditional with it. And so that project did really well. It got covered in Wired magazine. The Biennale bought it and sort of licensed it for a number of years as a mobile experience. And that helped me launch my company, Walking Cinema. And since then, we've done about 20 different productions in sites around the world, but still along the idea of audiences walking through an environment and getting a hybrid experience between digital media and the physical environment around them.
Yeah, as I was looking on your website, I was just seeing some examples of how you can tell the story of a place, or there's a paradox of like, how do you tell the story of a city? And I feel like there's ways in which that each location has a history. And in that history, there's ways that you can get access to the past, to the present, but also to see how those stories of the past are connected to the present, or that the spirit of them sometimes carry through. And so the character of a place can be explored through augmented reality and spatial audio, which it seems like the core part. But there's also this larger paradox of how you tell the story of a city, and it seems to be that you collapse it down into each individual locations and tell the stories of each of those locations, and by perhaps maybe an aggregate, maybe you can discern a larger story about the character of a city. So I don't know if you've thought about the balance between the story of a city versus like how each individual place maybe tells a larger story that's connected to a larger whole.
I've been working on this question for like 20 years. And the big thing that I think we see, you know, both in the work that I do, but in general, in a lot of these VR projects, is character. You know, if you can create a character that audiences can attach to and want to spend more time with, and there's something emotionally relevant about what the character is going through, it really helps you jump into a story. I mean, when I started this, there was a lot of thinking about like, oh, people want to walk through cities and get like kind of a historic photograph in a place, or even what we're seeing now too with the idea of sculptures, layers of place, right? That you'd walk through Austin and sort of a sculpture would pop up. And what I found is like, people don't want to do that. You know, there's been a lot of platforms. History Pin is one of them, where people can, you know, kind of walk around and get more information, but they really do need a story, I think, to drive them into a deeper, longer experience. So an example would be that a museum approached us about telling the story of different immigrant communities in San Francisco. And one of the neighborhoods they wanted to focus on was the Castro, which is this gay mecca that most people know around the world, but it wasn't always gay. It was a neighborhood that was in the 1950s, very Irish Catholic, and in fact, very homophobic. And, you know, there would have been a way to tell that story kind of like through a historian's voice of like, well, then this wave of immigration came and then this and this and this happened. But we found a man, Mike Michelle. He calls himself Mike Michelle because he was both this early drag performer called Michelle, and he's also Mike the hairdresser. And in 1957, he got the first hair salon in the Castro, and he was openly gay. And so he basically walks you through his own personal story of seeing that neighborhood transform from Irish Catholic to this gay mecca with Harvey Milk and all these other characters appeared. But by having his voice and his challenges that he faced lead you through that story, it keeps people a lot more locked in. And so that's something that we've worked on for the last 20 years, is really just finding just incredible places and learning the history, but finding that key character that you can inhabit that will take you through that site. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's move to the immersive impact review, because I feel like that's something that was just announced like 4 or 5 days ago, or first launched like 4 days ago. Friday it launched. as a digital site. You can go look at all the various different articles. What was the origin story for the Immersive Impact Review?
Yeah, for sure. So it's started by a group called the Immersive Experience Alliance. I don't know if you've heard of them, but it's a group of mostly academics who a couple years ago, this is 2024, got together here at South by Southwest and began thinking about how can we start sharing best practices around creating immersive media, teaching immersive media, and thinking about this big question of impact. I mean, you know, from like the beginning days with VR, empathy machines, and there was this idea that empathy in itself is impact, you know, that people feeling things, especially putting themselves in other shoes, is a form of impact. But, you know, there's more to it than that, right? There's more ambition, I think, that a lot of producers have around affecting communities, impacting politics, possibly going after corporations that are accused of things. Like there's bigger aims here, I think, with quite a few of impact productions. And so that was a concern of this group. I joined them about a year and a half ago, you know, because they were interested in how the work I was doing with location-based stuff, especially illuminating groups that are lesser known through these walking tours, and we sort of shared interests. And so the Immersive Impact Review was sort of in the back of their minds. We met with folks from AGOG here at South by Southwest a year ago and said, hey, we want to put out a journal. And what was really interesting about that meeting is they said, don't make it too academic. You know, don't make something that's going to be like pages of data or dry, that's not going to be inviting. So we sort of walked out of that meeting with like, we want to apply for funding from AGOG, but we want to find something that is both super appealing, you know, almost like a glossy magazine, you know, where it's got stories and it's got events that are popular that you can jump into, but also still has this kind of academic backbone. And that's really the DNA that you'll see when you look through the Immersive Impact Review. If people are curious, it's at immersiveimpactreview.com. And it comes out every 6 months. The articles are super approachable. They're illustrated, there's photographs, and they're often told through the perspective of somebody who's both thinking about the industry overall, but is also involved as a creative or in somehow in creating projects within the industry. And so it's very grounded. We go through multiple drafts usually in writing these things. It's not like people are just submitting ideas. We're really trying to customize the articles to have kind of what we're talking about before, like, is there a character people can attach to? Is there an issue that's going to drive us through reading these somewhat longer articles that go from like 2,000 to 6,000 words? So they're longer articles, but we really want to make sure that they don't feel long, they don't feel dragged out, that there's enough variation and almost like scene setting, jumping from scene to scene as we get into different topics. So that's kind of how we do it. Each issue has a theme. The theme that was just released, the first theme is values, that gets into both what is the value of this stuff in the sense of impact. If it's really expensive to produce this, and if audiences are really small, there's sort of that economic question of like, could money be better spent? So we want to open up that question, but also ethical values. You know, what kind of ethical issues do we run into in creating this media? So an example of that is Ioana, an author from Greece, who's a PhD student in journalism, writes about studying in 10 different newsrooms across Europe who are all producing impact VR projects, mostly about conflict zones and natural disasters. And all the ethical questions that come up as they start testing these on audiences. And Ioana interviewed 100 different people who had experienced these kinds of projects and really realized there's no ethical standards yet across newsrooms and how to present this media, how to collect it, and how to caretake of audiences who are receiving it. So that's an example of one article that got into the ethical side of the question of value.
Yeah. And so in your article, you write about how in 2007 was An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore, which you sort of cite as an origin point for the crossover for what is a piece of media that actually had a lot of impact in terms of trying to tell a broader story. There's a lot of like slideshow data and information, but how do you turn the information in a slideshow into a bit of a one-man show of a performance of something that he's adding this dramatic metaphors of he's climbing up the ladder to like point at, you know, just these moments in the film that I remember from watching it back in 2007. And so, yeah, maybe you could elaborate on why you chose Inconvenient Truth as kind of like an origin point for really looking at what's happening with impact media.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've heard the term flatty before to describe 2D media in a sort of pejorative way. And if anything, like a 2007 PowerPoint presentation is as flatty as you can get. You know, it's just usually presenting data. It's like, how can you make a movie about a presentation? And I think that's an interesting starting point for the Immersive Impact Review, is that in some ways, you know, academic writing can be flat. Academic writing can be, you know, let's just give you a stream of information and there's a certain format to it. But somehow An Inconvenient Truth kept you riveted. You know, it was partly Davis Guggenheim, the director's use of B-roll footage to illustrate and go beyond just a PowerPoint presentation. But also Al Gore's really freaking smart, you know, and he starts informing you of things that you just didn't know. And he begins building emotional value around something that is full of data, you know, and the way that he presents it, and specifically the way that the movie allows us to shift perspectives. They present views of the Earth from outer space in two very, very different ways. In the beginning, they show Earthrise, which was the first photo taken in 1968, I believe, of the Earth. And that just, it's just beautiful. It's this floating blue-white marble, you know, that's half lit in outer space. And that's just arresting. It gets you to care about the beauty of the place. But by the end, he has another photo called Little Blue Dot, where you just see like a tiny, tiny pixel of blue in this vast, you know, sea of dust out in the cold, enormous cosmos. And, you know, in that sense, he gets you to care about Earth, that, you know, it's the only thing we've got. It's the only thing we know that supports life. And we've got to take care of it. And that to me is very immersive. It's very VR in the sense that, like, we've seen a lot of projects here that radically shift our point of view and get us to care about a place or a character by allowing us to move from different perspectives. For instance, I think it's The Clouds Are 2,000 Meters Up is, you know, this big award-winning VR presentation that I think is also stealing the show here at South by Southwest. So much of that film is about inhabiting different perspectives and putting the audience, making them sometimes feel small, making them sometimes feel like they're right next to a character. Sometimes you're in a maze overlooking things. So I think perspective shift on that film really got me thinking about, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be VR to use immersive techniques, and that there's a relationship between old and new storytelling, and especially a film that, you know, won an Academy Award, got Gore a Nobel Peace Prize, and led to 3,500 activists who got trained in presenting this film in classrooms, living rooms, theaters around the world. I mean, to me, that's kind of what's missing right now from VR, is seeing that massive distribution network of people showing this stuff and helping create change. Yeah.
So it sounds like there's, you know, your intro article, there's some provocations, there's some research and some case studies. So maybe you could sort of give a bit of an overview for the different types of things that you're covering here in the first issue of the Immersive Impact Review.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. So yeah, some of them are sort of provocations, hot takes, and that's, not to be confused with somebody just on a soapbox sort of saying, like, distribution's horrible, we got to fix distribution, you know, complaining about how bad distribution is. You got to come with, like, a very unique point of view and data-backed, you know. So Mike Golombuski is a perfect example of a provocation, but from a person who's looking at this problem of digital distribution and specifically getting into what's happening on Steam when these projects move from a very successful festival run to being put up on digital platforms like Steam, and just how it doesn't translate.
And so you have like the museum context of a festival, and then you have like a gamer context where people are just within that context of Steam, people are expecting a certain level of agency, interactivity. And so when you put something that is in a very narrative context in that space, it doesn't seem to do well, or just kind of gets lost. But yet in a space like a film festival or in a museum context, cultural institutions, that's sort of exalted, where people are primed to sort of expect to have the tolerance to have an artistic experience, an experimental experience, or something that may be more narrative driven than agency driven.
Exactly. And he gets into that. You use the word exalted. Like, that's a key idea for him, is that we're kind of in a rarefied space right now where it's been curated. You've paid a lot of money for a badge, or you've been lucky enough to get a press badge, and you walk into this room and there's a scarcity feeling of like, am I going to be able to get on the list to see it? So it hypes up a lot of your emotional needs when you step into a festival experience of it. Whereas, you know, imagine a YouTube experience or Steam experience where it's there and there's thousands of others, and your quick way of seeing if it's good is by ratings and by category. And you don't care necessarily if it won an award at Sundance or at South by Southwest. And so he's very good at talking about that failure to translate from platform, he calls it platform, festival to platform. There's a sort of a disconnect there. But he also talks about emerging location-based entertainment networks that are coming out, that are beginning to give things like, you know, the clouds are 2,000 meters up, is, you know, going to do a run in various venues, I believe, around the world after this. And so, you know, that network seems a little more apropos than platforms right now. Maybe there'll be a new type of platform that's developed that helps us get closer to this kind of experience. So that's one type of provocation.
Just to jump in, just to say that I'm in the process of finishing up like around 100-page report from IFA DocLab R&D Summit, that a lot of the topic was around what the state of that current immersive distribution is in terms of all of these emerging networks and institutions that are in different forms, different strategies for how to do that. So yeah, when you actually asked me if I had a desire to sort of contribute a article, I kind of wanted to see what it was, but I've also been completely swamped. So sorry that I didn't get back, but I've been writing up a 100-page report that is basically going to be elaborating on some of these different topics that are alluded to in this first issue.
That's fantastic. When is that report coming
out? Well, it was past due. So I think the deadline is the end of the month. So I think they're going to be wrapping it up here by the end of the month, and then probably soon after that. We'll see how much longer it takes after that. I've been sort of vexed by the artificial intelligence moment in terms of trying to articulate what's happening with that and also where it may be going. And so there's, after coming here from South by Southwest, I have a lot clearer sense of where that story is emerging and some more of the ethical concerns. And so I think I'll be sort of fleshing that. So when I get back, I'll be finishing that up, and hopefully by within the next, I'd say, 4 to 6 weeks, get it out there. But it's something to look out for, because it ended up being like a lot more of a, almost like a manifesto for LBE independent distribution. You know, this is a problem that's been there for a while, but I actually feel like there's a moment here where there's not only the institutions like FI in Montreal, there's Excurio, there's the Domes and Cosm and Sphere, there's independent domes, there's lots of different indie flavored, like there's independent film and independent music. And I think there's a bit of the independent XR that has to sort of go outside of the existing corporate distribution mechanisms. And when you get outside of those corporate distribution mechanisms, then you get more of the independent spirit that kind of gets squashed by all the different at scale dimensions of how you have to kind of serve to these larger audiences. But I actually think that with the LBE space and these pieces that we've seen on the festival circuit, they're so enriching and amazing. And I've spent about a third of my coverage over the last 12 years or so focusing on that. But it is such a shame that there has been this disconnect between it not being widely distributed, people not seeing it. And so I've continued to cover it because I think it's important, and I want to track the people and also track the experiences and track my own experiences and track the innovations and how people are using the medium to tell stories. But there has been a lag between how I'm talking about these things and people are experiencing it, but it's a very insular group in a way that I actually think that we're at a point now where I expect these different types of experiences to be touring around to these different locations and to have much more of a context where people will go together. And there's also pressures of people having social experiences. And so there's other dimensions of civic society and how these XR projects were able to reinvigorate civic society and elements of civil society. So that was a big theme as well in terms of that was being discussed, but also how there's a dimension of how these projects, because of the LBE constraints, how you have to have more people see them at the same time. You end up having these group social experiences where people are together in this either virtual environment or shared space where it's naturally asking them to connect to each other in a way that the pressures of LBE to go beyond just a single player experience, but group experiences means that there's these kind of third spaces the idea that there's a home and there's work, but there's now these third spaces that are these immersive places that are going to be places for the reinvigoration of civic society.
Yeah, 100%. I think what you're getting at is that idea of community, right? That the positive of being in festivals right now, not widely distributed, is that you get an incredible stickiness of community, just even waiting in the lines to go to these things. It's like, hey, these are the people that really care and want to really see this stuff. And it creates an automatic intimacy. But at the same time, if you start talking about impact, and you're doing something that it's mostly at pretty expensive festivals that doesn't really get out there, especially to the communities that are impacted by these issues, that becomes an oxymoron that we hope the journal and your writing help begin to illuminate solutions for that. And really, you know, I think help authors and creators reach their final goals, which is, you know, getting these things out to broader audiences, especially people who are impacted by specific issues. Yeah. So that's part of what we're doing with the review. Category wise, beyond provocations, we have research articles. So as I mentioned, Joanna interviewed 100 people who experienced these immersive journalism experiences. We have another story from Kenya about research that was done around VR for impact investment, especially with rural farmers, where the investment decisions are often made by people who have never been out to the farm. And there's just generally like, well, I have doubts about investing, you know, this kind of distance concerns. But VR makes it feel like some of these investors can get a much more in-person experience of not just the farm itself, but their pipeline to get things from the farm into supermarkets. And so she profiles a specific project that they did with 6 different investment organizations and 1 rural farm in Kenya to see if there was impact in using VR in those decision-making processes. And then the other article is about symphonies. And so I'm laughing because I've heard a lot about operas and symphonies in VR lately. I don't know. It's just like kind of things are blowing up. But this specifically looks at the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra and their experiments over the last couple of years in bringing in non-traditional symphony audiences through immersive experiences. Some of them are in hardcore dance clubs in Charlotte, and some of them are through a mobile stage that they...
Is it live performance in there?
Performance, yeah. It's live immersive. They did another one called Become Ocean that was in, I think it's called the Bloom Arts. I'll have to check the name on it. But a big immersive space that's been created in Charlotte did a live symphony performance with beautiful projection mapping, a lighting of like basically ocean waters that was synced to the music that was being performed. So that's research that Mikhail did on that. And she's an insider. You know, she was working on the marketing and audience growth for the symphony overall and sort of gives you some of the hard data of what these experiments proved for them.
Yeah. And so did you cover all of the different authors and all the articles from, because there's also use cases, right?
Yeah, we're also interested in case studies and use cases. We didn't have a specific, I'd say, yeah, the symphony one was categorized as a case study. So we had 2 research, 1 case study and 1 provocation. We're also open, you know, to interviews, potentially to original work, be it creative writing or be it, you know, some piece of immersive media that we could plant into the magazine. But I'd say overall, beyond the categories, we're looking for people who are really good writers. And those are people who don't necessarily write in an academic stance, you know, more journalistic, who are used to writing articles that are well-paced, you know, have a sense of scene, really draw readers in, and have some sort of critical angle on them. You know, that's one of the things that we're trying to get at, is moving beyond some of the boosterism that's been in VR coverage, because a lot of people who cover VR love VR or produce VR and really want to see it do well. And so we're looking for people who want to be unbiased. And that means probably not writing about your own work, maybe something, a field that you're involved with or organizations you might know. But really, we're looking for writing that feels completely unbiased and is looking at things both good and bad as far as outcomes of projects, of the industry. And yeah, and also, you know, people who don't feel like anything's sacred, you know, that if there are institutions or patterns that people are seeing, we're hoping that the journal can be a place for freedom of expression and pointing out things that need to be fixed.
And do these articles have DOI numbers? Because usually like academic writing has like a document object identifiers.
No, we have not put it into that system yet. We're making sure that it's public access, but we are working with publishing houses who can help us put it into that system for academic. Yeah, basically what you're saying is like, if you're an academic writer, it's really important that you get indexed in these articles. And so we've set it up so that we do have those keywords identified, and that once we get it put into that DOI, into that system, these should be also accessible.
Okay, so it's in the works.
It's in the works, yeah. Okay.
That's good to hear. Because I guess it's a differentiating factor between being just an online web magazine, which I think we had the Immerse, which was like a kind of a medium-based articles, which was going for a while. I think maybe the funding stopped on that. But so we've had previous iterations. And then I do find that there's this gap between what's happening in the sort of academic sphere and what's happening with the kind of frontiers of what's happening here, mostly because it costs a lot of money to come here. The budgets aren't always there. So the academic researchers don't necessarily have access to what's happening here. And so I've personally been a little bit less interested in tracking what those people are saying, because I feel like I get closer to what's happening by seeing the work myself and then talking directly to the artists. But there is this growing community of people who are interested in looking at it. And so I guess there's this gulf between the academic community and what people on the ground are seeing. And I feel like this feels like a bit of a bridge between those two worlds.
100%. Yeah, you nailed it. Is that there's great research going on, you know, in different universities that are looking more systematically at like, what is this stuff doing? How can we solve some of the big questions about, you know, stop calling them empathy? That was like one of the biggest things we saw from early submissions. It's like, people are tired of this term empathy machines. And you might hear it from some of the producers coming here, although, you know, they'll still say, hey, if this makes you feel some empathy, that's fine. But having that sort of wider vista, that historic view on things of like, well, 10 years ago, we were all kind of writing this view of what impact would look like. And now today we're beginning to see less and less satisfaction. And that's based on key articles that were written in 2018, 2019, 2022, you know, these years after the initial clouds over CIDRA, you know, big projects came out and that made a buzz. People began to chart a sort of dissatisfaction with that idea that empathy is like a big end goal of VR for impact. And so, yeah, what we're helping is saying, well, what are the new models? What are some of the new terms or ideas that are going to help us fill in why we're doing this and what impact means? The other ways that these kind of, you could say, yeah, more obscure kind of perspectives or measurement, you know, so much of what you see in these festivals is kind of what you're doing is I did a project. My research of like how it's doing is I'm either just talking to people afterwards. How did you like it? Or judges, you know, either affirm or give me award or not, or do something like you, you know, put a microphone in people's places. Hey, give me a few quotes. And what people tend to do is just cherry pick the best quotes. You know, it turns into PR. And so we hope to counterbalance some of that impression that's been put out there by the producers and their media partners, you know, about how great and certain things are, with a more journalistic and academic standpoint of like, let's really see what audiences are doing, you know, through unbiased study. If we want to talk to people, let's talk to people in waves with questions that aren't slanted towards, what did you love about my project? You know, I swear to God, last year I had an experience exactly like that, where I walked out a project and somebody's direct questions were all direct. You know, I'm doing research. All the questions were directed about, tell me what you loved about it, you know? So yeah, that's one of the cycles that we're trying to break through, but at the same time, not make it too academic, too much feeling like you're reading a research paper. The research should be in there, but almost like, you know, think about a Rolling Stone article or Harper's, if you read that, where you are reading topics that are well researched and you're getting some data in there, but you're kind of on a roll. It's just so interesting. You want to keep reading.
Yeah. This question was coming up at the IFA Doc Lab R&D Summit, where how do you know that you're actually having impact? How do you measure it, quantify it? How do you know you get some sort of like value for the money that's invested? So I think that everybody that's receiving like government funding or funders, they're all asking the same question. And then as I was sort of thinking about it, you know, I'm a little bit, I mean, I have an electrical engineering degree and I'm kind of an aspiring philosopher, but my practice is oral history. And I like very empirical of like having my lived and body experiences. And then I sort of have these philosophical musings to try to like make sense of my experiences. And so I'm like more trying to develop this framing of phenomenology and experiential design. And so looking at it through the lens of experience, but also this resistance towards this quantification. Like anytime I see like this is reduced down to a number, I feel like it sort of collapses the complexity of how there's these other relational dynamics of a piece that kind of works as a whole, you know, all these things working together. And so as I was writing up this report, I was just like really meditating on this question. I sort of went down three different routes of, there's a co-creation book by Kat Cizek and William Urquijo where they were talking about how sometimes pieces of media were generated to solely facilitate community development. And so there are fragments, and those fragments would be a fragment of a piece of media. And the whole purpose of that fragment would be to facilitate a community development process. And that's different than, say, creating a film and then saying, what's the impact of this film? And so there could be like, how many people saw the film as a number, but how do you quantify the relational importance of a community that is now more resilient, more connected, feels like there's more trust. There's all these kind of more, I'd say, qualitative dimensions that are more relational. And then there's also a new book that just came out last month, Joseph Pine's follow-on from the experience economy. It's the transformation economy. And so what he's sort of proposing here is that we're moving into an era where he kind of called the experience economy in terms of like, this is the next phase. And so he's saying the next phase is going to be transformation media. So people seeking out specifically experiences that are going to transform them. And so what does that mean? How do you quantify that? And so he had a quote in his book that says, even if you, and so one model, one business model for transformation economy is you only pay if you're transformed. Like if you do something and you don't feel transformed, we don't get to take money. And yet now, obviously, not every place can do that. So he says, even if you can't do that, then you should operate as if you are doing that so that you're providing transformational experiences and that people feel like they're going to pay and get what they want, which is like transformation. So transformation on demand certainly could be very problematic, just like empathy machine. But I do think there is something there in terms of finding experiences that are deeply meaningful to people and are moving them in some way, which is, again, maybe more on the emotional level, a sense of meaning and purpose that, again, can't always be quantified into a number. And then the third reference was this economist, which is Mariana Mazzucato, who is talking about mission-oriented frameworks and policies for as you start to look about, like, it's basically the moonshot. If you want to go to the moon, you go to the moon, you have this big vision, and then there's all these sort of layers of this goal, and you have these individual tasks, and then you, from that, you have little ways that you kind of chip away at that. So like, we want to solve climate change. Okay, fine. Okay, here's all that other things that are part of that, that you sort of go down this ladder, and there's this one thing that you can have communities involved in actually changing this within the context of a larger mission-oriented. So this idea of the mission-oriented framing, I think, is also another way. But all of these are kind of more process relational rather than sort of reductive materialist, like give me a number, give me some statistics. So that's sort of my framing of how I've been thinking about that question.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what the review is for. It's a thought space for people to throw out new ideas for ways to measure things. I would say too, like when we talk about academia and we talk about numbers, there's still a lot of academia based on totally different ways to measure things that don't have to do with numbers, that are either qualitative, linguistically oriented. Anthropology has its own ways to measure culture. You know, so I don't think academia is reductive at all in the sense that they tend towards, you know, numerical or system. That's one approach. But I would say that the three examples that you give are really interesting because if you talk about fragments, for instance, it's very different from story. You know, and I think going into creating this magazine, there was a sort of unseen bias towards narrative uses of VR when we know that there's a ton of other types of VR. And that's one of the light bulb moments in the first issue was when we got the submission by an academic, Dr. Langa, but who has worked in media departments before for this project on VR for microfinance. We were like, there was a story to it. It was basically like a mini documentary about, you know, farm to supermarket and the process that, but it was not supposed to be like a riveting, you know, oh, wow, I'm locked in my chair, but, you know, a 10 or 15 minute assessment tool. And what's brilliant about the article, she's very clear about that, that a lot of what's been written about VR for impact, starting with Clouds for Cedra, tends to be these kind of narratively or filmically produced VR experiences. And she's like, we are not trying to do that at all. We are creating an assessment tool using VR. And I think that's a key point about the magazine is that, yes, there's this kind of charismatic side of VR that's all around us here. And we're sitting right next to the XR Experience Room at South by Southwest. And there's a ton of things that are just beautiful to look at, wonderful worlds to get inside of. But that's not, we don't want to limit our understanding of what VR, XR, or immersive are just to this context. So that's another key distinguishing point. One other thing too, I'd say about that transformational metric that you got at is that in my own work, what I've seen people say by having these location-based AR audio experiences is that afterwards they started looking at the city differently. You know, that you, in a way, gave me a little lens. Specifically, it was about what redevelopment did to San Francisco, but it's a lens that works in a lot of cities. Where in the 1960s and 70s, redevelopment agencies across the country were doing similar types of projects, usually targeting African-American populations. And so all of a sudden, you have this key that unlocks different neighborhoods around the country. And for audiences, that was really powerful to sort of see, oh my God, the story repeats itself. Almost like when you're in the midst of a really good novel and then you step outside and all of a sudden people seem like they're characters from that story. You're like still in that mood. So I think that's something too that would be interesting to measure is like, is there sort of a persistence, a vision of this thing? Like, did I step out of it and start looking at the world differently? If so, how long did that last? And so I guess approaching that keyword transformational, although that's a big word. I don't know if I'd ever want to throw that at any producer. You got to transform people or they're not going to pay, you know?
Yeah. And the Mariana Mazzucato work also came up in the conversation, and she's been doing lots of different policy papers, but I feel like that type of model where some of these like EU and in UK, there's more and more of these kind of mission-oriented funding mechanisms where you fund the thing until you achieve it, basically. And that the metric of success is like, we landed on the moon, as an example. And I don't know if we're ever like solving the end state of like climate change, but the idea is that there's a way that you can start to have a big moonshot. And with that moonshot, you have all these sort of like lists of other things that are towards that. So I feel like that it might be part of, you know, as funding organizations and entities and foundations, you know, AGOG's doing a great job, and but they're not necessarily like an umbrella group to be able to start to really deeply fund experiences at scale. I think they're being more strategic and trying to build out the ecosystem in different ways. But with that, there's still going to be a desire to see, like, are there ways that a piece of media could fit within a larger mission that is going to serve either the awareness building or getting people to buy in, or, you know, the end result, the metric for success is, you know, did you accomplish this goal? Did you land on the moon type of thing?
It's a good example. So in doing this site-specific augmented reality audio walks, we've talked with city departments who have, you know, massive problems to solve. Like, one example was in Washington, D.C., the Department of Planning basically has to create a whole new type of way to channel stormwater based on those disastrous rains from 2 and 3 years ago that ended up killing people, flooding basements. But to do that, they're going to be tearing up roads for years to create these kind of like trenches at the side for water to subside better. And to build those trenches, they need to get community buy-in. And to get community buy-in, they traditionally have meetings where they show a PowerPoint presentation, back to Al Gore, a PowerPoint presentation, hey, we're going to be tearing up your streets. And if people don't like it, it could delay these things for years and years. And so one of the ways that they're looking at this site-specific augmented reality is a cool way to get people up walking. So all of a sudden, they have a better idea of what the issue is. They could see, like, if we don't do this, this is what the next rains could do to this neighborhood or worse. But then secondly, what is the intervention going to look like and what's it going to do to stop that problem? So that's, I think, one example of what you're talking about, like a big social need that we have or infrastructure need that we have where XR could fit in to helping solve that.
Yeah. And you said you might have any, do you have any questions or anything you wanted to ask me?
Oh, yeah. My big thing is you've been on the media landscape for a decade.
So I'm going on 12 years in May. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. I am curious, you know, where you see this magazine fitting in, or if you've just been like unsatisfied with certain aspects of how XR is being covered right now.
Oh, well, I think it's great to have, well, there has been like Upload VR, Road to VR. They've been very game centric. You know, maybe they'll have a little bit of coverage that's happening at the festival circuit, but gaming has never really been my interest. And so it's always great from my perspective to have people that are thinking around seeing XR, immersive storytelling, immersive art as this broader movement of art that has merits to be covered within its own right. And it's also like not necessarily tethered to the technology. I mean, I've been with the Voices of VR because it's like well known, the people recognize it, but there's also like to focus my whole name of the podcast on the technology is sort of like I'm thinking more and more. It's like, okay, now it might be time to be like really to expand out to like experiential design or whatever. Like it's much more broad than the type of stuff that I cover. Sometimes people don't even have any like technology.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying, I was going through the floor here and saying like, I wonder if Kent would be in this one because it's not really VR. Would he do this one because it's AR or because it's like more live? And I'm like, I think you're probably open to different types of.
Oh, I'm covering everything that's here. And so, I mean, there was a, you know, Handle with Care was basically a box of pieces of paper that, you know, facilitated emergent social dynamics. And so that's, I think my lens has turned more and more towards phenomenology and experiential design and looking at through like different qualities of presence rather than what's being mediated by the technology. And so yeah, I think it's good to have these different types of discussions and thought pieces. Cause I do think that there's sort of like the seeds are being planted for the next phase. We're kind of at a liminal new cycle beginning where there's been a lot of retrospective look at what's come before the themes of off the internet of If a Doc Lab. There's a number of projects like Lucas Risotto and others who are reflecting on, you know, the different dying aspects of the internet and then what's being born anew. And so also this movement towards like looking at how civic society could be reinvigorated because we've been so alienated from this kind of escapist portals of addiction of our cell phones. And then how do we actually come together and be with humans, I think is also a big theme. And so there's these larger archetypal cycle themes of like, we're in this beginning of a new phase where we're ready to start to kind of start anew, as it were, where it's like, things have matured in terms of the medium and from my perspective, in terms of the storytelling. There's still innovations, but there's some core like interdisciplinary fusions that I've seen that it's pretty, I think there's still stuff with like AI that's still like radically new, but I think there's a lot of like maturation for how folks have been like blending together to different disciplines to tell stories in a unique way. And so I think with that, we're ready to start to bring that out to, it's been incubating here. Now it's ready to take it out to the masses in a way that with the masses, it's less around people being isolated and seen in their homes in the VR model, but people going to a group experience and having more of a shared communal experience with people within the context of their community, because not only the LBE sort of constraints, but even if there's the intent for artists and creators to be deliberately thinking about how to manage the civic society when that's sort of been destroyed by corporations.
Cool. And just in the media landscape, I'm curious if you've felt any of these urges that I feel around like boosterism, you know, like we've had a lot of boosterism in the media. I'm curious too what you think about long form, you know, that we're trying to do long form writing about it.
Well, so I talked to Eric Cohn of IndieWire, and what he said from a film analog, he said this is the VR community is similar to the experimental film community because everybody who's within the context of that community knows each other. And they're also the ones who are critiquing each other, but they have to hold back in a sense that they're friends, right? I find that because I'm sort of like the foremost critic of sorts, although I'm more oral historian or I do offer critique, but I have to hold myself back because I am in relationship to people and like my words carry a lot of weight. And so if there was a group of like, say, 20 or 30 or 50 critics, then I could be more open with my thoughts because that wouldn't be like, I'm the kingmaker and what I say is going to make or break her career. I don't want that. No one wants that. That's why I prefer the mode of oral history because I have a chance to just be in relationship and talk. And I think there's another aspect, which is that most criticism is based upon you watch it and you make your judgment. But I take a much more relational approach where sometimes I don't fully understand a piece until I have a chance to understand the process in which it was created. But also because there are so many interactive components, I can't explore every possibility space. I've only explored one possibility space. So I only have my experience. And so I have to kind of understand the architecture of a piece. And I can only get that through conversation. And so there's other aspects of how I don't understand the full context of a piece often until I have a chance to talk to the creator about that. And that's not been a practice of criticism yet. So I think there's a number of different dynamics there. But I think if there's more people that are openly talking about stuff of what's working, what's not working, that there would be more of a ability to have more critical feedback about things.
Yeah. I've always believed criticism makes stuff better, you know? And like, if we really love this stuff, we should be ripping into what's not working and celebrating what is. But, you know, it does seem to be like, you're exactly right. Like, the numbers are too small right now for people to take bigger gambles on saying, like, you know, especially with sort of the established names, you know, there's some fear that there's going to be a backlash or it's going to hurt that person or hurt you by making that criticism. Whereas I think if it's just mean-spirited, of course not. But if it's like you really looked at it and you really talked to people maybe who've experienced it too and this problem came up, I think that's helpful ultimately. And I think it shines light. It's what media does great. You know, it shines light in spaces that we don't necessarily are able to look at in clear light. I guess my only other thing that I'd mention too is that, like, what I'm discovering by doing longer form articles is that they lend themselves to short form too. You know, so we've got this story from the Kenya microfinance story is like 7,000 words, but, you know, there's going to be an interview, like 15 minute audio interview that'll be associated with it. There's like shorter presentations that we're working for to present potentially in a GOG house and places like that. So, you know, one of the things I'm learning is that, like, to do media right, and I think you've probably experimented with this too, there can be like the base media, the long form article, but then what you really want to do is present it in smaller chunks so that people can absorb it in different formats.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, I've leaned upon the 45 minutes to an hour conversation with the creator as the primary and sole format of trying to distill it down to other formats. I'm producing like 2.8 episodes a week per week for the last 11 and a half, you know, going on 12 years. And so basically I don't have time too much to distill out into other formats, although those other formats are going to be important. But I have thought about like other ways to, you know, like a memory palace of really getting access to the full complexity, or a taxonomy that allows me to, with more specificity, tag different intersections or topics and be able to maybe emerge it. So I do think that there is a risk of just having things reduced down to like things that have too much context collapse versus like, how do you really distill it down into the value? For me, I haven't been able to find that magical formula for how to like reduce down these conversations down into something that's like a pithy one-liner. I think most of what I've been doing is like the talks. And so I do talks that try to synthesize it, like the big philosophical integrations of all these things that I'm seeing. And then part of what I'm thinking about a lot is translating those philosophical ideas into specific frameworks or examples or classes and, you know, eventually a book at some point, I hope. No current plans, but it's something that I'm sort of working towards.
Like workshops, like smaller containers for some of this knowledge that you're getting.
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked to do masterclasses and workshops that are sort of more just a lecture that's maybe a couple hours, but extending it out into more of a series or like a class, a lecture series, or something eventually into a book. And then I know some people have been like turning to like Substack or Patreon to like write chapters. And so there's some maturation of my own sort of philosophical thinking of like really grounding it on process philosophy and the elements and sort of context, quality, character, and story, and trying to break down experiences into this framework, and how I'm still sort of like looking at these different intersections. And so there's a back and forth between this deeper philosophical ideas that I've been developing and coming to events like this to see experiences. And then there's like a feedback loop between what I'm able, it's a basically like a memory palace of like how I can see 12 hours of content in a couple of days and then facilitate like 20 to 25 hours of conversations over 3 days. It's like, it's a lot to try to like consume, integrate, process, digest, and then unpack with each creator through conversations. And the only way I'm able to do that is that, well, I'm a bit of a binge watcher, but also that there's this framework that I have that as I go through the experiences, I'm categorizing and kind of remembering things, then paying attention to things in the way that I've sort of been training my own attunement to my own attention of my phenomenology, my feelings, my experiences, my agency, you know, how I'm embodied, how I'm thinking about things. So all these things I'm like synthesizing and then bringing that out to what's new and novel in the course of how people are cultivating that. So
it does feel like that synthesis is one of the real powers of what you're doing. You are getting like a vast number of experiences, but it does sound like you could take a thin slice of, I don't know, for example, stories about relationships with parents or something like that, and just do, you know, a cut through of all the different ways that you've thought about that and talked about that, or get into things like festivals moving to Steam. Like, you probably have had, you know, numerous stories. So like, that's where I think Yeah, that these journals are, you know, you're working on a media platform, Immersive Impact Review is working on a platform, finding ways that we can take these longer, deeper articles and find topics and ways to present those topics through lectures, through workshops, through classes. I think that's a big goal of ours too.
Awesome. Well, as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think the ultimate potential for all this immersive media might be and what it might be able to enable.
Yeah, I think the ultimate potential is, first of all, to have a heightened experience of the world. You know, and to me, the world includes having media experiences that take you far into places you couldn't normally go to, but especially in my case, to really appreciate the world that's immediately around you. That includes history, architecture, landscape, but also the people around you. And so I do really hope that this love of immersive leads to community connections, you know, people that you do keep seeing year after year, who share ideas with you, who push you to do better, who bring you a lot of comfort, joy, delight, and thought. You know, that's really a community vision I think I have for all this stuff. So, and it's been great meeting you. I really appreciate you getting back to me and supporting this new voice that's getting out there.
Awesome. Is there anything else left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Yes. Get excited about the outdoors. You know, these are great to have these festivals that put us in these small showrooms where we go in and we see a bunch of immersive media, but we're in wonderful places like Austin, like New York City, like Toronto, you know, and that I hope that you start exploring more physical spaces, especially as augmented reality and devices that carry that become more accessible. I really do hope that you explore getting people out of doors, because once you get out of a building, amazing serendipity and encounters can happen in your life and with nature.
Did you do the MIT Layers of Place?
I did do it, and I appreciated the places that it took me around town. And in fact, I did two walking experiences. The other one was Eclipse from 2 years ago that you might remember. I rewalked it, and there was a nice synchronicity between those two projects. They both go to the electric company, have very different things to say about those sites, but take you on wonderful walks of the city. And honestly, like, to me, that's some of my favorite things about going to these festivals, is just the feeling of being in a new place and getting these media projects that really attach you to those locations in ways that stay with you. You know, that's what it's been like for me. My memories tend to be attached to people and places. And so those to me were very, very memorable experiences, because they used sites to tell their stories.
Beautiful. And people can submit articles to the Immersive Impact Review. When's the next deadline that people should know?
Yeah, the second issue deadline starts April 1st and ends May 15th. So we're accepting submissions starting April 1st. You can go to immersiveimpactreview.com/submit, and you'll be able to see the call starting April 1st.
And the biannual release is sort of like in March around South by Southwest, and then is the next one in September around Venice?
Exactly. It'll probably be in October, a little bit after Venice. But yeah, we're planning releases in the spring and in the fall. And I'd also mention that anybody that writes for the Immersive Impact Review does receive a small stipend. And so we do believe in paying our writers.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast to give a lot more insight as to what's happening with the Immersive Impact Review, what you're doing with Walk-In Cinema, and your kind of early look into how to tell the stories of a place through these characters. Yeah, and I'm excited to see that there's a new entrant out there, that it's a place that's funded by Agog. I guess we didn't talk about that. So kind of getting support from Agog.
I just want to give some thanks to them. Like, Agog is a really incredible force that's come in the last couple of years to Immersive. They're incredibly supportive, you know, so even just a conversation, if it doesn't lead to funding, they'll find ways to, you know, support you by connecting you to people. And just, they are unlike any other funding agency. They tend to work faster in the decision-making process, and they make it feel much more personal. And I just really want to thank everybody at Agog who made the Immersive Impact Review happen in a matter of months from idea to publishing. Thank you all very much.
Awesome. Yeah. And thank you for all the work you're doing to help lead up. And I'm looking forward to see where it all goes here in the future. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Ken. All right. Have a good festival.
So that was Michael Epstein, and he was talking about the Immersive Impact Review, which launched in Austin, Texas on March 13th, 2026. So I've got a number of different takeaways about this interview is that, first of all, well, it's great to see this hybrid journalistic slash academic journal that is starting to dig into a lot of these broader questions around how do we start to quantify and qualify different aspects of what makes immersive media different than other media. And so I'm excited to see lots of folks from both academia and the broader industry just kind of reflecting on these broader ideas of social impact. And so there was just the Meaningful XR conference over this past weekend here in Portland, Oregon. I think it's like the third year that they've done it. And so it's a little bit more of the academic community coming in and talking about this, but I was invited to give an opening keynote there. And so in that keynote, I'm sort of elaborating on a lot of the different perspectives that I'm coming from here in this conversation. And also the IFIT Doc Lab report that I was referencing is starting to also dig into a lot of these other frameworks in terms of both the Transformation Economy, which is a book that I had a conversation with Joe Pine now, Mariano Mazzucato's work with Mission Oriented Economy, and then also Kat Cizak and William Urquijo did a whole book on collective wisdom and co-creation, this idea of media fragments versus the full breadth of immersive experience. And so there's some other references that I point folks to, because this was a question that comes up a lot in terms of how do we justify or make sense of why it makes sense to invest in something like immersive media. And I want to read just a slide that was presented in a VR chat meeting a couple of weeks ago for Agog. And they said climate communication can often feel technical, abstract, or overwhelming. And immersive media creates emotional proximity, embodiment, and connection. And so there's something around the immersive quality of how you can have these embodied experiences that I think touch people in a more emotional and visceral way. And I think it sticks with people. And so coming up with a broader model to see how this level of embodiment, your emotions, your agency, but also your mental stimulation and the information that's being transferred, it creates like a more holistic experience that then I think is having some degree of impact, and then we can kind of experientially understand that. And I think there's this broader effort of trying to come up with the different frameworks and ways of describing that. For me personally, I've found Alfred North Whitehead's process philosophy, which is a pain experientialist framework that starts to center experience in a way that I don't think that other philosophies or frameworks do as much. And so trying to frame a lot of these different questions in a more process relational way or through the lens of phenomenology is a lot of what I am focusing in on. And that's sort of what I dive into the keynote that I'll be airing as an episode in this little mini series for projects that are funded by Agog, looking at these broader questions of how do you start to quantify or qualify different aspects of immersive media impact. So that's all I have for today. And I just wanted to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast. And so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring you this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.